Uncle Don here with the 305th opening of my porcupine petting zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Before launching into the doom and gloom, I'll give you the good news. Gordon Campbell's grand plan to hand the building of our new Portman Bridge over to private interests has come off the rails. The consortium planning to scoop this valuable cash cow with its perpetual $3 tolls failed to come up with financing. Therefore, our provincial government has no choice but to do the job itself. We'll never know how much public money was spent in planning and enticements to the private sector, but it's all down a big rat hole now. Let's hope that the failure sounds the death knell for all future P3 giveaways of public assets to the corporate sector. Stephen Harper is taking no steps to repatriate Omar Khadr. He's the last remaining citizen of a Western power imprisoned in the Guantanamo concentration camp, so one might be forgiven for thinking Canada would follow the example of Australia and Great Britain in requesting his repatriation. The case against this former child soldier, now an adult, is flimsy at best. It would hold up in no civilized court of law. He was a minor. There's no evidence that he threw a hand grenade killing an American soldier. And, after all, he was under siege, and a case could be made that if he did fight, it was self-defense. Given the facts of the case, why don't they allow Omar to come home? The answer is risible. Foreign Minister Lawrence Cannon declared, "Canada fully respects the process of American government has put forward, and we will await the outcome of that process before anything takes place." Some process. Omar's court-appointed lawyer has been forbidden to visit his client in Guantanamo. What kind of process denies a defendant counsel? These military tribunals represent an ad hoc attempt to give a patina of respectability to a procedure that is indefensible. What is our Prime Minister afraid of? Justice? Suppose you're a school principal wanting to maximize average results for your students in mandated province-wide tests. Would it be fair to pick the dumbest students and send them on a field trip on test day? Such a plan would be slapped down by the government and the Fraser Institute, for sure. All right, let's say the financial lords of the universe are distressed by the drop in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Would it be kosher to drop failing corporations from their calculations and substitute ones that are growing? Well, that's exactly what they're doing. The keepers of the Dow are likely to drop the 5 worst performers from their calculations, namely General Electric, Alcoa, Bank of America, Citicorp, and General Motors. In their place would be any number of healthy stocks. This is just another example of how figures are manipulated by the powerful to produce results they desire. If we truly want to pull out of this recession depression by stimulating our domestic economy, we have many devils to fight to get spending going again. One of the major ones is this insidious concept of family values. You know, the ideal of mom, dad, and 2 1/4 kids sharing a modest home with Spot the dog and Puff the cat. Charming. Mother baking cookies while father smokes his pipe. Oop, scratch that, no secondhand smoke allowed in this image. Father and mother watching Pap on television with the obedient children at their feet. Church on Sunday and washing on Monday. The whole bit. This stable, happy nuclear family is subversive. Families need to be in conflict if they are to contribute their share to recovery. We need mom to be a shopaholic, buying junk to boost her sense of self-worth. Dad would well be a piss tank, drinking the family into a hole. Little Johnny would do his bit through petty theft, stimulating victims to replace pilfered assets. Janie could be turning tricks to support her drug habit. And finally, the family should disintegrate, encouraging economic activity by their needing separate accommodation, furniture, and pets. Let us recognize that the stable nuclear family, and worse yet, the extended multi-generational family, is the enemy of growth, and we should be doing all we can to foster their disintegration. An old friend in Calgary convinced me to subscribe to Alberta Views magazine. I've no love for that province, but I do respect the minority of concerned individuals having the perseverance to oppose Alberta's endless one-party government. There's always something in that monthly publication to justify the price of subscription. Here's an excerpt from the latest magazine. It's an opinion piece by Lyndon Goyette. Quote, "For the first time in my life, I envy Americans. The feeling surprises me. They're staring at a humiliating economic collapse. They continue to feel the sting of the world's scorn for the errors of the Bush years. They're fighting two distinct wars they can't win in Iraq and Afghanistan, and their enemies are spilling into other countries. Americans confront problems we can't begin to imagine in Canada, so why do I envy them? They have a leader who inspires them. We do not. Listen again to Obama's inaugural address. On this day, we come to proclaim an end to the petty grievances and false promises, the recrimination and worn-out dogmas that for far too long have strangled our politics. Can you imagine a Canadian prime minister or premier saying these words in the winter of 2009? Close quote. I know how she feels. That same magazine carries several items on so-called think tanks. According to Alberta Views, quote, think tanks are like universities, minus the students and minus the systems of peer review and other mechanisms that academia uses to promote diversity of thought. Real academics are expected to conduct their research first and draw their conclusions second, but this process is often reversed at most policy-driven think tanks, close quote. Here in British Columbia, we have the Fraser Institute, a thinly disguised propaganda mill. Their supposed conclusions from alleged studies always follow a right-wing line. Cut taxes, privatize public assets, corporations good, government bad. Every year, they trumpet their Tax Freedom Day around mid-year, the day when they declare Canadian individuals stop working for governments and begin accumulating earnings for themselves. They sweep all manner of taxes into their calculations, while ignoring that taxes are not a burden, but the price we pay for civilization. I don't see their senior fellows, their stable of ideological nincompoops and washed-up politicians, moving to countries lacking that burden. These are invariably third-world failed states or offshore tax havens fattened on the wealth of criminals escaping legitimate taxation in their homelands. The Fraser Institute's rankings of schools is thinly disguised promotion of private schools at the expense of public ones. Yes, private schools can produce higher average test scores than public ones. They can also cherry-pick their students when government schools cannot. Because of their high fees, the majority of their students have had privileged upbringing not available to the poorer peers. I know the difference as I have attended both public and private schools. Generous corporate support allows the Fraser Institute to distribute their propaganda far and wide. Libraries, especially those in colleges and universities, are showered with unsolicited books bearing their inevitable slant and half-truths. Even public institutions like the CBC report things like that Tax Freedom Day in an effort to create an illusion of balance demanded of right-wing governments. Think tanks are fairly new. The first acknowledged one was the RAND Corporation, set up by the U.S. military after World War II. The world now hosts some 3,500 of these creatures, half of which are in the United States. Virtually all of them exist to influence politics at home and abroad. Most publish reports supporting their worldviews. I know of none that is truly objective, whether their views tend to be right, left, or center. Some of these outfits acknowledge their supporters. The Fraser Institute does not. All they will say is that a third of their $12 million budget comes from organizations and corporations, half from foundations, and 13% from individuals. Alberta's perpetual conservative government has followed closely the recommendations of the Fraser Institute. They cut taxes, reduced the civil service, privatized liquor stores, amalgamated school and health boards, closed hospitals and schools, and eliminated public debt at the expense of civil society. Now that the unrestrained capitalist economy is suddenly suffering, they haven't the social safety net left to provide a cushion for citizens. Thanks also to Stephen Harper and his liberal predecessors, also captives of right-wing think tanks, who've mostly dismantled UI cover and universal welfare. Without the social infrastructure to aid individuals suffering this recession, the only answer left to government seems to be throw money at the very institutions which, by following a conservative path of unalloyed greed, have caused our collapse. It's nuts. In the early 80s, I found myself working under the Northern Regional Director of Corrections here in Prince George. In those days, our SOCRED government was waging war on its public service, and privatization was the order of march. That's when our public road maintenance department was dismantled. I witnessed jail food services given to an American company behind grand promises from VersaFoods, the winner of the first contract. Ah, yes, there would be nutritionally balanced meals overseen by professionals. Prisoners would be enrolled in an introductory food service education program to be coordinated with the College of New Caledonia, leading to certifications. We were presented with a sample weekly menu, which provoked an urge in me to put a brick through a window of the cop shop so I could eat like that. The contract was awarded, and suddenly, nothing happened. No training of prisoners, no nutritious meals, no professional oversight, but lots of hot dogs and greasy French fries. This was my introduction to the fact that contractors will promise the sun and moon, but once they are entrenched, they do as they damn well please. Not only were peripheral services privatized, but there was a push to turn entire prisons over to corporations. Again, we were bombarded with propaganda from the likes of the Corrections Corporation of America. Cost would be reduced, security increased, with grand training and rehabilitation programs instituted. Fortunately, this giveaway never happened in British Columbia, as even the ideologues of the social credit government saw through the flowers and smelled the bullshit. And as my boss once said, if the Queen sees fit to take away the liberty of a person, it is the Queen's responsibility to care for him or her. This is not a responsibility that can be delegated. The United States and Great Britain didn't share this view, and both countries now host many private prisons. Their corporate owners have secured long-term contracts guaranteeing them the steady flow of income based on the number of warm bodies they house. This has fostered dangerous corruption within the system. It was exposed in Pennsylvania as two judges were discovered to have taken bribes from a private prison to sentence youth to their facilities. The existence of private prisons demands a regular supply of convicts, whether crime rates rise or fall. Politicians respond by legislating mandatory sentences and inventing new crimes. Police and courts are glad to oblige. Another dangerous product of private prisons is the use of literal captive labor to produce goods and services for pennies per hour to compete with products of free labor on the outside. Profits can be enormous and outside wages undermined. Giving public services over to profit-oriented corporations is fraught with dangers. Whether it is private prisons or private armies like Blackwater's, all such actions are dangerous to democracy and our control of our society. Each week I receive a stock market outlook newsletter from an advisor in New York. At the risk of giving away secrets of the markets, I will here share a shred of wisdom from this gentleman. Quote, adding to the fundamental economic overlay, one might conclude that despite a downturn in market valuation, there is sufficient reason to be positive about sector rotation and a rebalance of asset allocation potential, close quote. And you can take that to the bank. Here we are, early in 2009, at the intersection of reality and fantasy. The reality is collapse of a worldwide structure of unreal money, with its house of cards, esoteric financial instruments, one piled upon another and all built on sand. Imaginary money, created from nothing, has returned to the ether. When phantom assets evaporated, they left behind the very real residue of debt, corporate, public, and private. The fantasy is assurance that moving debt load from private companies and underwater homeowners to government bonds will bring the world economy back to life. Obama is shoveling a third of $1 trillion out the American Treasury door while issuing public insurance on many trillions more private debt. Canada's government under Harper is pushing a multi-billion-dollar bill, supposedly for stimulus of our economy, which hides a plethora of items from a right-wing wish list. They can't even take care of their friends without hiding unrelated stuff in the bill. Economic experts, the ones who last year told us that all was well, now publicly declare that orchestrated stimulus measures will solve this universal problem. They're whistling past the graveyard. The public's bombarded with conflicting messages, and no one seems to put them together. On the one hand, we've been told that this meltdown is unprecedented. On the other, comparisons are made with previous recessions in predicting recovery. If the situation is unique, the outcome may be unique also. The Globe and Mail quotes unnamed business people as saying that significant pickup is not expected before late 2009 or 2010. Is this based on evidence or wishful thinking? Jean-Claude Trichet, head of the European Central Bank, said the following, We live in nonlinear times. The classic economic models and theories cannot be applied, and future development cannot be foreseen. His recommendation for unspecified emergency measures represents motion disguised as progress. He hasn't a clue. The president of one Canadian consulting firm predicts, "The positive impact of these stimulus measures on the economic forecast will be lost in the wash of changes to the forecast caused by the weakening performance of the economic indicators driving economic growth." Translation, we're wasting a lot of public money for little effect. The Wall Street Journal says that the Obama team plans to buy hundreds of billions of dollars in distressed assets from the private sector in order to free up frozen credit. These distressed assets are also called legacy assets, as in General Motors having legacy pension obligations. To those of us in the real world, a legacy is something left in a will, a bequest. In Orwellian English, a legacy means financial obligations without backing. Rather than just buy the junk on corporate books, the U.S. government wants to create a public-private partnership. Does that sound familiar? Individuals and pension funds would be invited to contribute to this fund. And what, pray tell, would entice a sane person to buy debt termed toxic? Easy. Government guarantees. Like our Canadian P3 scams, this one merely hides public debt behind a facade. Losses will eventually be added to the public debt. The more I look at our present situation and the cures proposed to restore supposed normality, the more it looks like the final solution will be to evaporate outstanding debts through orchestrated inflation. Fine for debtors, but the dislocations are frightening for anyone with savings or on a fixed income. Hang on for a rough ride. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. I love egregious examples of chutzpah. Bernard Madoff ripped off $50 billion in the largest Ponzi scheme in history. Over years, he conned people and institutions to hand him money, supposedly cleverly invested to earn great profits. No one could see through his strategies, but they lined up to give him their money anyway. When the whole mess was finally exposed, poor Bernie was almost impecunious. Thank goodness he was saved from homelessness by his generous wife. She, it seemed, managed to save a few bucks from household expenses. In fact, she has about $62 million in assets, plus a $7 million apartment in Manhattan. Lawyers for the Madoffs claim that these assets are untouchable as they are not in his name. This wee pile has nothing to do with his crimes. I wonder how all those people left stranded by Bernie's ripoffs feel about this living out his life in luxury while they lose their homes and incomes. Maybe they might think that courts should scoop Ruth's assets for compensation of those ripped off. The claim that these assets are untouchable is my candidate for the chutzpah award of the decade. British Columbia is the best place on earth. It must be, as it says so on your license plates, if, of course, you paid extra for those advertising in the Olympics. Some citizens might not realize there's no better place to live. For instance, families trying to get by on a minimum wage. This hasn't been increased since 2001, although inflation has been steadily eating into the generous $8 per hour before deductions. Soon BC will be able to brag that we share with Prince Edward Island the honor of having the lowest minimum wages in Canada. Our Liberal government members claim that few workers earn less than the proposed $10 minimum wage. You might not realize that when you pass local McDonald's joints with huge signs advertising work. $8.50 part-time, $9.50 full-time. When you buy junk fast food, rest assured the person serving you also eats there, because he or she can't afford good food. Even MLA Pat Bell, owner of two Prince George eateries paying less, say that raising the minimum is bad. Bad for his business, bad for his profits. Homeless people in Vancouver, crashed in doorways within sight of the billion-dollar athlete's village, might not realize how good they have it in this best place on earth. Members of the Legislative Assembly who have awarded themselves handsome increases know that this is the best place on earth, as do the senior bureaucrats given 30% increases. We have the scenery providing a suitable background for that best place claim. It's just the dolts in government who give the lie to that immodest claim. Stelco, a Canadian steel company tracing its origins back to 1861, has closed for the first time in its history. Even during the Depression, the last one that is, it maintained operations. What happened this year? In 2006, the company was under bankruptcy protection. Then Rodney Mott, an executive of the United States Steel Company, invested $5.5 million of his own money and, together with $100 million from the Ontario government, bought the company. In August of 2007, he flipped Stelco to his parent, U.S. Steel, for $1.2 billion and walked away with a windfall of $67 million. Not bad for an investment of $5.5 million for 1 year. By opening Canadian companies to foreign buyouts, we sacrifice our sovereignty, our claim to reasonable taxes, and our jobs to the whim of people with no loyalty to us and our values. Canadians are some of the greatest suckers on the planet. Time for some good news to relieve the stress. U.S. Senator Alan Spector, top-ranking Republican member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, claims that the Bush regime committed war crimes and some could face prosecution. That would be splendid, but there's a possible trap being laid here. There are those favoring a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to be set up and dig into the so-called anti-terrorism measures, including torture. If such a commission were to grant immunity to those testifying, it could protect Bush-era war criminals from penalties. What is needed is war crimes trials, like those in Nuremberg after World War II. I say give the guilty bastards a fair trial, and then hang them high. Isn't it ironic that an auction raised nearly $2 million from the sale of a handful of items belonging to a man, Mahatma Gandhi, who eschewed personal wealth? Just think, this guy was strolling around in a pair of sandals and simple eyeglasses worth a fortune. If he only knew. In case you want to get in on the ground floor of next generation's fortune, my glasses, boots, and even knickers are for sale. Make offers at the studio of CFUR at any time. 37 long years ago, I traveled in a van across India. An obligatory stop was the holy city of Varanasi on the Ganges. A friend and I wanted to see the ritual burning of bodies on the banks of the river, so we attempted to make our way to the water through a warren of alleys comprising the waterway's borders. We couldn't find a way, as the maze always seemed to disgorge us further from our destination. Eventually, an enterprising youth attached himself to us, offering to be our guide. He led us to the place of cremation, where we witnessed the ritual. When the bodies were reduced to ashes, they were consigned to the holy river, there to mingle with the sewage, industrial waste, and mixed flotsam dumped by inhabitants of millions of folks upstream. We learned from our guide that the waters of this waterway were holy, as the gods purified them. It was hard to believe in this divine cleansing while watching people bathing and drinking downstream from others relieving themselves. Dying pilgrims made their way to Varanasi to be cremated and have their ashes mixed in the holy river. This was a ticket to Nirvana. We asked whether everyone who could afford to be cremated there was burned. Oh, no, indeed. The bodies of holy men and smallpox victims were dumped in the river whole for buzzards to feed upon as they drifted. Why smallpox victims? Because, sir, smallpox is holy. That sealed my opinions on Indian popular culture. Show me a society that worships smallpox, and I'll show you one witnessing my swift departure. Last weekend's Globe and Mail carries the story of a man who dedicates his life to trying to clean up the Ganges. He has an uphill battle, probably impossible. Along its 2,500-kilometer length, the river is an open sewer serving a half-billion souls living within its basin. Industries dump untreated toxic effluent. Sewers carry human waste, likewise untreated. Within the bounds of Varanasi alone, there are 32 open sewer drains. Every attempt to direct government effort at cleaning up the system is overwhelmed by a bureaucracy that sucks up any funds allocated, and nothing happens. As India presents itself as an emerging economic giant, it cannot cover up the fact that its major river is a deadly conduit for poisons, typhoid, polio, cholera, dysentery, trachoma, and hepatitis. I wish them all power in changing habits and enforcing laws. However, as long as superstitious individuals believe that drinking their neighbor's sewage is an act of grace, nothing will happen and citizens will continue to die like flies. Pity poor Rogers Communication. They can't make any money by renting movies at $3.99 each, plus a $2 charge, to avoid late charges. They have other sources of income, though. For instance, they own specialty television channels catering to the tastes of splinters of the television addict spectrum. One of these is the Outdoor Living Network, which I would expect to cover things like, outdoor living. I don't know what this entails, but it might lean heavily on Canada's homeless or overseas refugees in desert tent cities. Rogers is not content with this formula. They're petitioning our broadcast regulator for permission to intersperse outdoor living features with such things as movies, outdoors, situation comedies, outdoors, and hockey games, presumably indoors. They want to fill a quarter of their schedules with this stuff. I don't get it. If a broadcaster obtains a license to fill a particular niche, why are they not held to their proposal? When they cannot secure an audience or sponsors, perhaps they should relinquish their channel to a broadcaster catering to more popular topic. This is a tiny example of today's culture in which, if one cannot win the game, one changes the rules. Here's another example of a tactic very useful to politicians and governments. When things go wrong in one sphere, focus attention on another. Harper's government is fumbling the ball on rescuing the economy. Its purported rescue package in Parliament throws several billion dollars around, but also hides some totally unrelated items precious to conservatives. When they came under criticism for this bill, there was a sudden crisis grabbing the headlines. As a diversion, most useful in Cold War days, Harper declared, "The Russians are coming." What the hell, it worked back then, although it rings a bit hollow now. Two Russian bombers on patrol came close to Canadian airspace, prompting Canadian fighter jets to valiantly intercept them and supposedly turn them back. This was not news. It's a game that's been played for decades by both sides, testing each other's air defenses. No big deal. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russians bowed out of the game for a spell, only now returning. Although I suppose the Americans continue to play silly bugger with their beleaguered opponent. Peter McKay, trying to rise above his stature, declared that Russia has been warned to give notice of such exercises, although that would defeat their purpose, and I doubt if they'd offer the same, if we offer the same courtesy. Well, Peter's gunning for the job of NATO chief, so he has to bulk up his international image. As to the alleged incursion, General Jean Renault, commander of North American Aerospace Defense Command, downplayed the incident. He stated that no international rules were broken, nor did the Russians enter Canadian airspace. He said, quote, "The Russians have conducted themselves professionally. They have maintained compliance with the international rules of airspace sovereignty and have not entered the international airspace of either of our countries," close quote. A tempest in a teapot designed to cover the real news of the day. This ends the 305th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. See y'all next week on this station, you hear?